Annie McCullough, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations. This is your first book, and it's an excellent start. The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw, and The Burden of Greatness. First book, how did this project come about?
I covered the Dodgers for several years for the Los Angeles Times. I was the beat writer there, and so wrote a lot about Kershaw. While I was covering the team, wrote a lot about him after moving over to the Athletic in 2019. I felt like, he for basically from 2013 to 2020, he was kind of the central figure of every postseason. It was kind of every October was a referendum on his ability to win a championship. And I felt like when the team won in 2020, it kind of put an end to that story. Or at least, there was a conclusion to it, I guess. And I had some conversations with him in 2021, where he, seemed like a bit more reflective, I guess, on his career. And a bit more open to, had a bit more perspective on just kind of how things had gone in the previous 15 years or so. And so I approached him in May of 2022 and said I would be interested in writing a book about him. He agreed to participate in it, and we went from there. So yeah, I mean, I feel like he is the best pitcher of his generation. I feel like his career is really, fascinating in terms of, some of the choices he's made. He's a, figure of reverence and importance in Los Angeles. And so there were a lot of things that added up that he felt worthy of kind of like a full scale, biography.
Well, it's lucky you had his cooperation. From what I understand, a lot of ball players aren't interested in, and I guess it's the authorized biography with their blessings and whatnot. One of the things that
Yeah, just to be clear, this book is not authorized.
oh,
So,
okay.
yeah, it's not authorized. No, it's I mean, he talked to me for it, but it's not like he hasn't read it. He didn't offer suggestions. It's my book. So just as because authorization, it's a technical term that means like he actually like, read over the book and said like, okay, you can print this. There's none of that.
Oh, thank you for clearing that up, because that's
Yeah.
always been something I was wondering about. I mean, I can understand if it was if you're ghostwriting his memoir and
Sure.
things like that, but for a biography, that's a good
Yeah.
distinction.
Yeah, because when they say like unauthorized, it's like it's the story they don't want you to know. And it's like, no, it just means that like he didn't, it's not his book, it's my book. But he was like a willing participant in it. We talked a lot for it. He was his cooperation made the book much, much better, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes
Yeah.
total sense. And you did interview hundreds of people for
Yeah.
this book. Well, one of the things that surprised me, well, me being a certain age, is the way the media has been reporting on high school athletes more and more.
Okay.
I have Baseball America with their prospect lists and
Sure.
all the other outlets with their prospect lists, and the It used to be college, reporting on college was like something new that they wouldn't do. Now they're going back to high school, and even like it almost seems like 13 and 14-year-olds
Right.
are under the
Right.
microscope now. One of the things that's been a bugaboo of mine is superlatives in titles, but when it comes to this book, The Last of His Kind, I'm thinking that this might be a
Yeah.
very appropriate title, because you don't have pitchers anymore who will throw 250 innings a year. You don't have pitchers who will want to throw
Right.
250 innings a year. And so talk about how you came up with the title.
Yeah, I mean, the simplest explanation is it sounds kind of cool. Right. Like it's a good turn of phrase. But I also think that it is fitting given his place in the baseball landscape. As you mentioned, like I really do believe he is the last, or it's going to be quite some time before there's a pitcher who you can really sort of connect to the lineage of, Pedro Martinez to Nolan Ryan to, Bob Gibson, Sandy Koufax, who was given that same sort of responsibility, right, for sort of carrying a team. And I think that's not to slight like the talent or the effort of, modern pitchers. It's just the game has changed and the way pitchers are deployed is significantly different. And so, if you look right now, like at the current landscape, there's probably four technically active pitchers who have a really good shot at the Hall of Fame. Justin Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer, Zach Greinke, who is not officially retired, and Kershaw. And I think all four of them, you know, are going to be in the Hall of Fame. Three will probably be first ballot. It might take Greinke a little bit. But after that, among active pitchers, there's no one even in shouting distance right now of meeting the, you know, historical sort of requirements. Gerrit Cole is on track, but it's still going to require, you know, five, six more seasons of what he's been doing, which is not an easy thing. He's dealing with an elbow injury. And beyond Cole, there's no one even on pace for a Hall of Fame sort of track. And, you know, part of the book is explaining how that came to be and, you know, some of the changes within the game that led teams to basically asking less of starting pitchers. And part of it was seeing that how the sort of the required, like the sort of what was asked of pitchers in the past was so sort of onerous that if someone like Kershaw could not handle it going up against modern hitters, all the technology and things that they have, that it probably wasn't the best way to go about, you know, winning games. And so using, you know, Kershaw's story, you sort of understand the decline of the starting pitcher around him, if that makes sense.
I'm wondering if in your experience in interviewing high school and college personnel, does Moneyball trickle down to that level too?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little, you know, removed from that. It's the idea essentially of generating swing and miss has become so ubiquitous and the most important thing that pitchers can do, that has trumped everything. Kershaw obviously is a pitcher who in his career has racked up a lot of strikeouts. You know, he's, you know, within, he's like 45 away from 3,000. But he was never a pitcher who, you know, predicated himself on generating swing and miss. He predicated himself on getting outs. But the modern game is so dialed in to just how to get strikeouts that is essentially what almost every pitcher trains for. It's what teams look for. It's what they pay players for. And that in general leads to shorter outings, you know, more usage of relievers, just a different sort of pitching paradigm.
Well, let's talk about the rest of the title, the burden of greatness. So that can be taken on a few different levels. It's, you know, the fans' expectations of someone who has had the career that someone like he has had. It's also the family. Now, he came from a situation where he was relatively economically impaired. His mother and father split when he was relatively young, and the burden he must have felt, not just to succeed for the sake of his own career, but for family issues. So talk about how you decided on that aspect of the title.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of the book is really about that. And I think someone of his stature, you know, performing at the level that he does carries a external burden, an external, you know, responsibility, you know, within games, within the course of the season, especially in the postseason. But he's also a person who's grappling with, you know, the stresses he places upon himself, right? And the expectations that he sets for himself and his sort of quest to meet them. And that is, you know, what makes him the person he is, the player he is that sort of, you know, internal combustion engine that is going at all times that, you know, pushes him forward essentially. And so, you know, the book is about what it's like essentially to have spent 20 years feeling like, you know, every start is a referendum on your future in some ways. You know, he felt that when he was 14, 15, 16 years old, when he realized, you know, that his best chance to go to college, to make some money, to have a different life than the one that, you know, to match his peers growing up in this very affluent area in Dallas called Highland Park, you know, his best chance was through baseball. And so he put an inordinate amount of pressure on himself from a very young age. And even as he, you know, reached the majors, even as he made a lot of money, even as he won, you know, all the awards you can think of, finally won the World Series, that sort of internal, you know, combustion engine has not stopped. It's like living in the hull of a ship for, you know, 20 years, basically. And the book is kind of about what that does to a person in the process.
So let's talk about it. It does have some mental health aspects as a book, the burdens that he's had. You talk about Greinke and, you know, his social anxiety issues are fairly well reported. You didn't used to have books that dealt with these issues. I mean, certainly Olympic athletes, tennis players, golfers in recent years have stepped away from the game because of that. The only other player I can think of who really dealt with mental health issues that were reported was Jimmy Pearsall. And you're going back 50, 60 years for what he did and how bizarre it was to write about that then. Now it's become a little more commonplace. What kind of responsibility did you feel in reporting that aspect of Kershaw's life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's somewhat challenging in that, like, he's doesn't have any diagnosed, mental health issues. With Greinke, it was kind of simple, right? Greinke kind of came out and said, "I deal with social anxiety and I take medication for it." Kershaw doesn't have that sort of, DSM type affliction. Now, like, I know from talking to people who've read the book and asked, like, if you asked him if he was OCD, and I'm like, we talked about a lot of stuff, and I think he is someone who is incredibly well adjusted. And he's very bright and he's very sort of focused on what he's doing on a day-to-day basis. And I think that he is fairly open, especially in the last chapter, of the book about how much he sometimes struggles to admit that things are going wrong or admit that he's having, could kind of express his feelings. It's something that, his wife has really been trying to challenge him to do more as he grows older. And, they think about how they want to raise their kids. Like, he's trying to be more communicative. But so I think, there were many times during this process where I was like, dude, you should go to therapy. And he's like, I don't know. And I'm like, I'm in therapy. It's actually pretty helpful. You can try. Like, if I can afford it, you can too. But like, I think it's he comes from, he's a product of his environment. And that is maybe less common. It's also like his life's going pretty well. He is able to sort of handle the stresses he's put on himself. But it also, it comes with a cost. Like, it's not the easiest thing in the world waking up and being him, just in part for all the responsibility he feels for, himself, for his family, for whatever he's trying to do in baseball at that moment, all that sort of stuff.
Well, you talk about OCD, especially among starting pitchers. You have people who follow a very strict routine. You hear about it all the time, like, don't talk to this guy on the day he's pitching. The day before he's pitching, he's going to do this. 2 days before, he's going to do that. I wonder, teams are employing more and more different types of physical therapists. In your experience, are any of them turning toward the mental aspects of therapy?
A lot of them have, mental skills coaches and in that sort of resources available. A lot of teams have guys travel with them. So the resources are there. Yeah, I would say that's one thing that, especially in the last 10 years, teams have figured out, like, hey, we should probably have someone on staff who can, talk to these guys about their brains. So yeah, now is Kershaw the sort of person who utilizes that resource? No, but it's available.
Now, when you say mental skills, exactly what does that mean? Because you say mental skills, and I'm thinking of how the players like visualize their approach
Sure.
to the game, but what about the
Yeah.
other parts of their life? Is that what these mental skills include?
It's more related to the game. I mean, I think that there's less of, while there are resources available for, like, having a therapist, like, the team in general doesn't employ someone to come in there and say, like, well, yes, and how does that relate to your father? It's more, like, it's, but I think in general, they like to have people around who could get these guys talking about their feelings, get them talking about, things outside of just, sort of rubbing dirt in it and trying to play through injuries, that type of stuff. So, there's both. It's more geared toward in-game competition, I would say.
And certainly, and unfortunately, there's still a stigma involved in the macho athlete seeking out that kind of, admitting that kind of
To an
weakness.
extent, I mean, it's less than it used to be. It's less than it used to be. And I think for the better. I think a lot of it sometimes it's less about, the baseball culture, but just the place, the culture you were raised in, or, if you come, for, like, what area of the country you're from, all that sorts of things, what sort of culture you've been exposed to, whether you grew up reading Philip Roth novels or not, whatever. Like, it's just, it's like, The idea, like for someone like me, the idea of going to therapy is not like stigmatized in any way. You know, like I write for a living, I live in Manhattan. Like this, you know, like it's everyone I know is in therapy. Baseball players are often drafted out of high school at 18, and grow up, you know, riding buses in the minor leagues. You know, it's just a different sort of existence, and your cultural sort of touchstones are different. And so, but I, in terms of like a stigma of like being made fun of and things like that, it's definitely way less than it was 10, 15 years ago.
I want to switch gears and talk about a little bit more about the process of writing this book. While you were doing the research, was there anything that surprised you from your original, I don't know, plan is the right word, but where you set
Yeah.
out with a goal. And was there anything that came up in your interviews and your research that kind of made you think, well, I wasn't expecting this?
Yeah, I mean, there was lots of stuff, lots of, you know, stories I heard along the way that I didn't know or, you know, hadn't heard about. I mean, there's like this great anecdote with him blowing off Sam Jackson, you know, when he came to visit the Dodgers that I had like in the first chapter that I heard early in the reporting process. And I was like, all right, I need to verify that and so I can get it in the book. You know, so there was lots of stuff along the way that like I didn't know about or didn't expect. No major curveballs in terms of like changing kind of where the book was going or, you know, kind of how I wanted to do it once I'd settled upon kind of what I want the structure to be. One thing I know that I think that I probably shouldn't have been surprised by this, but I was a little bit is like when I talked to Kershaw about some of the stuff with the postseason, he really framed, you know, some of the more recent defeats like 2021 and 2022 as more painful to deal with than, you know, some of the earlier ones like 13 and 14. And those in 13 and 14, you know, against the Cardinals are really seen as like these kind of formative, you know, collapses or whatever the kind of, you know, start the reputation for him as like a guy who's, you know, like a choker, quote unquote, in the postseason. And he, you know, it was like it actually hurts way more losing now than it did then because, you know, then you just felt like you'd come back every year. And now he's like, I'm aware I'm running out of time. And I just wasn't as prepared. I was a bit surprised that he sort of had the right, not the right perspective, but just like he understood that it was sort of almost over. You know, like a lot of athletes are aware that the end is coming, but they sort of like don't want to talk about it. And while he's not the sort of person who's like, oh yeah, like maybe I'll retire after this, maybe I'll retire after that, but he just understood, like, you know, I'm close to the end of the race. And that allowed me, as I was just sort of thinking through it and trying to sculpt the book, is to make it, you know, that the ending stages really be more about like athletic mortality than anything else, as best I could.
You're a beat writer, a newspaper writer. Talk about the difference in the way you work in putting a book length project together versus your day-to-day work.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think in some ways like writing is writing. But I had to really for this project, it was so big at the start that I really had to kind of take it in like bite-sized chunks. And like this isn't a unique strategy, but you know, I got back from spring training of 2023 last year. And or no, excuse me, in February of 2023, I wrote like a draft of the first chapter. And this is after I'd been reporting for about 6 months or so. I had spent a lot of time with him in Dallas in December. You know, so I felt like I was in a place where like I could kind of I knew where I wanted to start and I kind of wanted to go from there. And I wrote the first chapter and sent it off to some people and you know, got some feedback and things like that, but felt good, like, okay, the first chapter is done. And I had sort of outlined what I wanted the next 22 chapters to look like. And then I just kind of started when I got back from spring training in like a month later, I started in like middle of March. I just set a goal that was like, I have to write 100 words a day, you know, for this. So I wrote 100 words every day through the end of March. And then I got to April and it's like 250 words a day all through April. And then I got to May and it was 500 words a day. And basically from May until September, besides like I got married in June. And so I took a week off then. But every other day I wrote basically 500 words or more and looked up at the end of September. I'm like, well, I got 120,000 words. I got to cut a bunch of stuff now. So I really just tried to make it like, you know, simple, achievable, Not biting off too much, not burning myself out, but not ever, really taking too much time off. I have a cat who wakes me up at 3 or 4 in the morning most days. And so the cat would wake me up. I would, have breakfast, drink coffee. I would write, my 500 words, and I'll look up and be like, all right, it's 7:30. I wrote most of this book between 4 and 7 a.m. And then I would go and start my job, And so, it was a weird sort of routine, but I came to really enjoy it. I really loved the process of doing it. Love to do it again. And so, yeah, it was, but yeah, just the simple way of just like trying to, like small, manageable, attainable goals every day. And you look up and all of a sudden you're like, wow, I have a manuscript here.
A chicken and egg question. Did you write the book first and then seek out a publisher, or did you have a publisher who gave you the deadline of when this was due?
Yeah, I sold the book to Hachette in July of 2022. So maybe like a month or so after. I had talked to Kershaw and he had agreed to participate in it. We sent out a bunch of my agent and I sent out, well, my agent didn't, but my agent sent out a bunch of proposals to various publishers. Hachette was the one from the beginning who was really interested. And so, yeah, and they had set the deadline of, the fall of 2023 is when the manuscript will be due.
I want to talk again about the differences in writing. How the New York Times no longer has a standalone sports section, and I'm sure that's the same for a lot of other papers around the country. The Athletic is the provider of sports material for them now. How has that changed sports writing, in your opinion?
Which aspect?
The aspect that the newspapers do not have their own staffs for writing their sports.
I mean, most papers still do, to be honest, outside of the Times. I mean, that's why it was such a sort of seismic sort of event when the Times decided to redistribute their sports writers elsewhere. I think in general, like the more jobs, the better. I am always rooting for the industry to, continue to add people. I think it's a really fun profession, a very necessary profession. So, but in general, I mean, most newspapers still cover sports in part because readers, like news has become such a sort of like partisan issue in sports for the most part, kind of, is one thing that still somewhat acts as like a, communal experience. And so a lot, most papers still cover it pretty significantly, I would say.
One thing I noticed that was different from your book than most other books of this kind, there are no photos in it. Why was that decision? How and what?
It costs money. And so yeah, I mean, I don't know. It costs money, it takes a lot of time. It's not something that like in interest, I don't know. It probably made it worse. My publisher's kind of annoyed with me, but I just didn't really feel like it.
Oh, so that was
I
your
just
decision. You didn't want photos.
It was a mutual one. We had an agreement with the Dodgers to use some of their photos, but the photos they provided were not kind of what I was looking for. And then the process of like buying photos from the various services costs a lot of money, takes a lot of time, and I just didn't care. So.
What's it like being on the opposite side of the interviews sessions?
It's okay. I mean, I like talking about the book, like it's something that I dedicated a lot of time and thought to. And so it's really cool to, see the book out in the world. People seem to be enjoying it. The feedback's been, nice. And I'm proud of the work, and I'm glad that people, continue to be reading it. It's a weird process where like you dedicate all this time to trying to make the book good, and it becomes just like kind of a referendum on, how many get sold. And they tell you what the numbers are, and they're like, this is good. And I'm like, well, there's a lot more people in the world than that number. And so you kind of
Yeah, but
feel,
then they're not baseball fans.
So you're like, well, I don't know, there's definitely more people at Dodger Stadium last night than that number. But it's been, all in all, it's been really cool. We had some fun events when the book came out and got to, see a lot of readers have been, signing Book Plates. If anyone wants to, enjoy the book, I can, email me at buymccullough@gmail.com, and I've been, mailing out personalized book plates. And so, yeah, in general, it's been fun. I mean, I like talking about the book. It's something that is really important to me.
Is there a place where people can read more about you? Instagram, website?
I'm on Twitter. That's the only social media I use, just by McCullough on Twitter. I don't really use Twitter much anymore. I don't really post much because, like, I'm not, daily covering a team, but I post a lot of book updates there. And then you can read what I'm doing at The Athletic. I write them pretty frequently in the pages of The Athletic. So yeah, those are the two places I would say.
And we've been talking today with Andy McCullough, author of The Lesser Is Kind, Clayton Kershaw, and The Burden of Greatness. Excellent book. And I'm sure toward the end of the year, when they start considering baseball book awards from either Saber or Spitball Magazine or whoever else decides these things, I'm sure this is going to be one of the finalists. So, Andy,
Yeah, that'd be
thanks for
cool. I
talking with
don't know.
us today, and good luck the rest of the season.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This was fun.